Welcome to the 21st on this Martin Luther King holiday. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Almost 100 years ago, a week of race riots started with the drowning of a young black boy along the beach in Chicago. The topic of why those riots started is woven together with a history of black Chicago in a new children's book by Claire Hartfield. It's designed for readers 12 and up. It's called A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. Those few red drops, by the way, are a line from one of Carl Sandburg's poems. Claire Hartfield joins me now from Chicago. By the way, if you're in the Chicago area, she's got an event this evening at 6 p.m. at 57th Street Books. Hi, Claire. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
So in many ways, I think the history of Black Chicago reflects the history of your family. You first learned about this riot, the 1919 riot, from your grandmother. She lived through this?
She did. And yes, that is how I first heard about this riot. When I was a little girl, my grandmother used to tell me all sorts of stories from her own young days. And she told me this story of how she had just recently moved up to Chicago from New Orleans because she was raised in the South, and she came up to Chicago as part of the first wave of the Great Migration. And she had just gotten herself an apartment in the Black Belt, which is the neighborhood where most blacks lived, and she had gotten herself a job in a factory in the industrial community. And she was taking the streetcar home from work, and as it got closer and closer to the black community, she looked out her window and she saw these mobs of young men, both black and white, in the streets, fighting with one another and throwing rocks at the streetcar. And she was scared out of her mind.
How old was she then, Claire?
She was about 19 herself, actually.
Wow.
So she was really a young woman. And she made it home safely, so that was a good ending to the story for me when I was young and impressionable. But it was the beginning of a week-long riot that actually killed 38 people and left over 500 injured. You know, sometimes when you're a kid, you hear stories and then they tuck back into the back of your mind and you don't really think about them. But a couple of years ago, of course, we began to go through a lot of turbulence in our current day and age. And I was seeing scenes of people out in the streets on my television set. And it called up in me this memory of this story that my grandmother had told me. And I wanted to learn more about why it happened and how that might relate to what we're going through right now, what's different, what's the same. And that was the beginning of the book.
And why did you decide to, and I should point out, you're also a lawyer. So in addition to being a writer, you're a lawyer and you specialize in school segregation, desegregation litigation. What made you want to tackle this topic as a children's book?
You know, I have actually been involved for my entire career with children in education, and I get very excited about that career because it's really all about investing kids with the preparation that they will need to lead the future. And so it's full of optimism and joy, and I get to see young people all the time. But one thing that I know about young people from working with them is that when they get into a troubling situation, they think that this is all about them and it's the only thing that's ever happened, and they can get stuck in the middle of it and not know how to get out. One of the great things about knowing our history is that it helps us sort through our present, and then from there we can mobilize and get to a better future. And so this is not a book for young children, but once kids get to middle school and high school, they're ready for it. They know what's going on.
So the book's designed for ages 12 and up, correct?
Yes, that's right.
The book starts with the story of the riot, or just not even the details of it, just sort of the events leading up to it. But then you go back deep into Chicago's history and into Chicago history and also the history of when Black Americans first started coming to Chicago. Why did you want to do that as a setup to the riot?
You know, it's interesting. It wasn't something that I started out with intentionally. When I started doing the research, I thought, oh, I'll look a year or two back and the reasons will be right there. But as I started to look back, each time I would get to a certain key point, it would take me back even further. And it ended up taking me all the way back to the beginning days of Chicago. And then I could see, once I had done all that research, how the tensions, the racial tensions, built layer upon layer over decades. And it was really eye-opening for me, and I think it will be eye-opening for readers as well. And the issues that we're dealing with now are very complicated. That's why we don't solve them easily. But it really helps to be able to go and look at a situation that's very similar to ours, see how it started, what the middle was, how it ended, and what the aftermath was. And I think it can give us some tools to deal with our lives today.
I'm speaking with Claire Hartfield. She's the author of A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. And Claire, when you say that the book goes back, you do. You go way back. You go back to 1845. And someone I learned about reading this book, John Jones, who was the first Black Chicagoan elected to office. What did you find out about him? What do we know about him?
In the very early days, John Jones came up to Chicago before the Civil War. And there was not a large Black population back then, but those who came were coming for freedom, and they were coming to get away from, even if they were free Blacks in the South, as John Jones was, they were coming to get away from the uncertainty of their lives. It was very arbitrary living down in the South back then, and free Blacks could easily be sold into slavery and have very little, there was very little that they could do about it. So they looked up to Chicago, which was one of the cities that was most sympathetic to Blacks and the idea of freedom and was an important part of the Underground Railroad. And John Jones came up, started a tailoring business, and worked with whites and other Blacks in the city very hard to help Blacks that were fleeing slavery, and also on the measures that were taken leading up to the Civil War. So he was an instrumental part of getting Blacks to freedom in the first place. After the Civil War, when Blacks had rights, including the right to vote, as you say, he was the first Black elected from Chicago. And so he was a very important part of that early period.
In fact, I learned initially about Illinois' Black laws, right, that made it clear, this is before the Civil War, that while Black people were considered free in Illinois, they certainly were not equal. What did those laws look like?
Yeah, so, of course, in the North, Blacks were free. There wasn't slavery, but there was something that was an Illinois law. So it wasn't a local law, but it was an Illinois law called the Black Codes, and it prohibited Blacks from voting. It prohibited Blacks from sitting on juries. It prohibited Blacks from testifying in court. So what it did, in essence, was it confined Blacks to having very little power beyond their own personal lives. And even in their personal lives, they could be challenged and not have very many tools with which to fight back for themselves.
And of course, before the Civil War, the numbers of Black people in Illinois were pretty small.
Yes, they were very small. They consisted basically of a few free people who had come to Chicago, and then a trickling of slaves who came on the Underground Railroad. And many of those continued beyond Chicago up to Canada, where there was more certainty that they would not be dragged back into slavery. So the numbers were small. Once the Civil War was over, Illinois, and in particular Chicago, had a reputation of being very sympathetic to Blacks, and so the population grew by thousands at that point, and continued to grow until by World War I, which was 1917, the Black population had grown to be 50,000.
Yeah. And so, Claire, I think people might remember this. It's a good reminder that Illinois was actually the first state to ratify the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery. Around that time, Illinois abolished those Black laws we were just talking about. Is that sort of the beginning of when we see larger migration numbers of Black people coming to Illinois?
Yes. I break this down into two pieces. So post-Civil War until 1917, you begin to see Blacks coming in larger numbers. However, after World War I, that's when you have an incredible increase in the number of Blacks, and that World War One was the beginning of the Great Migration, and it was a pivot point in terms of the setup for blacks in Chicago, and brought us on the first leg of our road to where we are today.
And so among those people migrating, as you said, were your grandmother, your grandmother's family was from Louisiana. What about the rest of your family, and when did they come?
My grandfather actually came around that time as well. He was from Mississippi, and my grandparents met here in Chicago shortly after they arrived.
I think what people don't realize when they think about numbers of the Great Migration was just how massive it was. And I wonder, from your research, if you can tell us a little bit about how organizations like the Chicago Defender and other black newspapers, how the history of sort of the black press in Illinois played a role in people migrating here.
Absolutely. The Chicago Defender was the largest black newspaper in the world at that time, and Robert Abbott had come to Chicago himself from the South. He was born in the South and had come and started the Defender in the very early 1900s and built this paper into this nationwide news source for blacks around the country. The paper did several things, which were all pretty major. First of all, it expressed outrage at the oppression around the country, including lynchings and murders, as well as denial of basic rights to blacks. And white newspapers did not report these much at that time. And so blacks found an expression of what they were experiencing through the Chicago Defender. It also celebrated black successes, which was equally important, I think. And this, again, was not something that was done in white newspapers. As part of my research, I did look extensively at the Chicago Tribune, for example.
Yeah, and in fact, they were the Chicago Tribune.
Very rare to see.
Yeah, I was going to say, in fact, the Chicago Tribune actually probably made things a lot worse in a lot of times, just for sort of reinforcing stereotypes or racism or prejudice, it sort of seems.
They did. And so one of the things that is reminiscent of what we are going through today is that different media outlets had different constituencies, and you could take the same event and it would be reported very differently depending on which newspaper you were reading. And likewise, in the Tribune, or in the Defender, actually, they picked and chose which stories to report. And so the Tribune, for example, was very unlikely to report stories of black successes, and the Defender focused on black news and not on what was going on in the white community. And it's not the same thing as, you know, alternative news that we have now, but there are some similarities. And I think in looking back at how things were reported, readers will say, oh, I recognize that. So anyway, in the end, I think the most important thing that the Defender did in both reporting oppressions and successes is that it promoted a new black consciousness and really took blacks in terms of their thinking about themselves from the mentality that there was in slavery days, so that by the Great Migration, blacks had a sense of self that they were full citizens and they would assert themselves and stand up what's best for their race. And again, it's reminded me when I was doing the research of some things we're going through now. Obviously, we've come through a lot since that time, but some of what goes on, for example, with Black Lives Matter in asserting blacks asserting their own truth and not letting it be buried, that was also going on back in 1919, and the Chicago Defender was a huge part of that.
Yeah, it is really interesting, the parallels between today and now, as we often say, the cliche that history repeats itself is kind of an interesting thing to think about when you are looking at this book. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Claire Hartfield. She's an author, most recently of a book. It's just out. It's designed for readers 12, age 12 and up. It's called A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. We're going to continue talking to her about the history of Black Chicago. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Claire Hartfield. She is a Chicagoan, she's a lawyer, and she's an author. Her most recent book is called A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. If you're in the Chicago area, she's actually got an event this evening, this Martin Luther King Day, at 6 p.m. at the 57th Street Bookstore in Hyde Park to talk about this book. Claire, you know, just before the break, we were talking about the Chicago Defender, and it really struck me when I was reading the book about how people communicated, even though we're talking about a century ago. It was so interesting to see how communication was such an important part of movements and people, and how people, it struck me, I couldn't believe that people would actually write letters to the newspaper, to the Defender, saying, I'm looking for work in Chicago. Should I leave the South? Should I come? Is it safe to come?
Absolutely. Blacks all over the country looked to the Chicago Defender as a trusted source of advice. And before World War I, there weren't very many jobs in Chicago or in other northern cities available to blacks. And so even though blacks were living in very oppressive conditions in the South, and many would write letters to the Defender inquiring about whether they should move north, the Defender would discourage them from doing that because it was concerned that massive waves of blacks would get here and be unemployed. But with World War I and so many men going off to war and leaving the industrial factory lines empty, the labor leaders needed a new source of labor. And so they looked to blacks in the South to come up and fill those positions. And with that new labor opportunity available, the Chicago Defender changed its advice and said to blacks, yes, now is the time to come. And so they did. And within the course of the war years, which was only a couple of years, the black population in Chicago doubled. And that was a key point because there was a heating up of racial tensions related to that new large black population.
As you had this great migration, you had thousands of black people coming up from the South, relocating to Illinois, mostly to Chicago, because, as you said, the jobs were in Chicago. And it was fascinating to me to read about how the Chicago Urban League was a big welcoming association, was established to help people get settled, how they would have people literally meeting people at the train and handing out a card saying, if you need a job, if you need a place to stay, this is how we will help you. This is how we will help you acclimate to society and the culture of Chicago. How did you, even have in the book a picture of the card. How did you find that? How did you do research on that period?
Well, there are some wonderful sources of original source material in Chicago. There's the Chicago History Museum. The University of Illinois at Chicago has a great library with a lot of old material from that day and age. But yes, the Urban League, the Chicago Urban League, got its start right at the time of the Great Migration. You can imagine with 50,000 new people tumbling into the city that there could be mass chaos. But the Urban League was instrumental in organizing what was going on. And so, yes, people would get off the trains in the middle of Chicago. Some of them had relatives or friends who would meet them, but many of them did not. And they didn't know what they were doing, where they were going. Most of them were coming from very rural areas. They had never seen anything the likes of a city the size of Chicago with all of its industries, and they needed help. And the Urban League was fantastic in terms of, as you say, hooking them up to jobs and to housing when they could, and to also funneling them into some of the other organizations such as the Black Churches and the Wabash Street YMCA that help them get settled socially.
And they were all coming. Obviously, economics plays such an important role in this. And when you talk about the numbers of people in Chicago, we would be remiss if I didn't point out the tens of thousands of people who were working in the stockyards. And you spend quite a bit of time of this in the book talking about the stockyards, why it was such a major employer. I wonder if you could just lay out for us, you kind of talk about the different types of people who are working in the stockyards, and you have a category, a chapter that's called White Negroes. Can you explain who those people were?
Yeah, so Chicago became an industrial hub in the mid-1800s, primarily because it was located in the perfect spot at a time when there was great innovation in transportation. And so before the mid-1800s, there were lots of small businesses that dotted the countryside throughout the country. And in the mid-1800s, with this new web of railroads and canals that would allow boats to go from one side of the country to the other, businesses started to locate in key areas and build these massive complexes. So in 1865, the Union Stockyards were built in Chicago, and it was the largest stockyard in the world. And the other innovation that was really important was the development of something that was like the first assembly line. And what that did is it turned skilled jobs into unskilled, and it meant that the number of people who were employed multiplied. Now, these jobs were only offered for the most part to whites at that time. And so the big labor pool was the white community that was immigrating from Europe, including, in the first wave of that, the Irish. And the Irish came because of oppressive conditions in their own country, and they also came with hopes of grabbing hold of part of the American dream. What they found when they got here was that white Americans who were born here cast them to the bottom of the American heap, and this was during slavery time, remember, even made comparisons between the Irish community and blacks. And so some called Irish white Negroes, and they called blacks smoked Irish. And of course, this was not the dream that the Irish had had when they came over to be cast into this heap with people who were enslaved. And so that was the beginning of the development of rancor between some of the white working class immigrants and the black community.
How much of that do you think is the root of a lot of the racial tension that existed in Chicago at the time?
I think that, unfortunately, in our country's history, that one of the tragedies of making these racial separations is that whites, for the most part, don't want to be compared to blacks and don't want to be put in the same heap, because it can only mean for them that they're going to get the raw end of the deal. And that, I believe, is what the Irish were thinking when they wanted to separate themselves from blacks. And they did, in some ways, do that successfully, as all white European immigrants have. As they were here longer, they were able to move some people up the economic ladder. And when they moved into a different economic class, they were able to assimilate into the mainstream white society. For blacks, it was different, and it's something that's also looked at in the book. And this really points to the difference between issues that relate to class and issues that relate to race. Some blacks, like John Jones, who were entrepreneurial, and later, after the Civil War, there were black professionals, lawyers, doctors, businessmen, but they were still confined to this restricted city within a city that was the black community. And so that assimilation that the Irish eventually experienced did not occur for blacks.
I'm talking with Claire Hartfield. She's the author of A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. And Claire, before you get to the events of the riot, One of the things I think that we saw during the riot and then leading up to it was that a lot of hatred and violence was spread through rumors. And as you've sort of talked about comparison to today and now, as you've been thinking about it, I wonder how rumors were spread back then and how quickly.
Yeah, well, rumors were spread in two different ways, and I'm using the term rumors broadly. Within the week that led up to the riot, or even the day that led up to the riot, rumors were spread mouth to mouth. And so there was a particular event that occurred on Chicago's beach that Sunday that was the beginning point of the riot. The incident was observed by both blacks and whites, and then those people went back to their respective communities and reported on it, and they reported on it very, very differently. And they reported on it in ways which revved up the emotions of their communities to be in conflict with one another. The other source of rumors was, again, the media. And I don't know that this was necessarily intentional, but there was sometimes inaccurate reporting without a retraction.
And of course, the flashpoint for this was the death of a young boy who drowned, Eugene Williams. And in the end result was 38 people, both black and white, dead, more than 500 people injured, the riot going on for a week. And 1919, as it turns out, was a year that there were riots that happened all over the country in cities, although Chicago particularly, again, as you think about parallels between then and now, Chicago definitely, I think, gained a reputation nationally in the national media for being a very violent city during this incident in 1919. Claire, I wonder what it, as you talk about perspective, I wonder what it makes you think about people's perspectives as they look at incidents, as they think about the way information gets passed around. How did this book sort of change your thinking on that?
Well, I guess what I would say is this book made me realize that although the particulars of our lives now are different, and certainly some progress has been made, that the stories passed down from generation to generation, and so they form the mindset of who we are and what we are right now. For example, the story of this riot came to me through my grandmother, and so it gave me a certain perspective that's based on her experience as a black person in 1919. And I know that the same kind of stories passed down through various other communities, so it can harden the lines and perceptions that people have of one another. And now, of course, the media, and especially with the technological advances that we've made, hardens those lines even more. My hope in writing this book is that people will step back from their own perspective just a little bit and look at the perspective of other groups that were involved in 1919, and that may help them to ask the question, what are other groups thinking and feeling and experiencing now? And in that way, we might be able to break down some of the barriers that we have between the various communities and races.
And that, too, with the idea of thinking about that and the idea that this is designed for young people, for ages 12 and older, what do you want parents or teachers or families to think about as they are hopefully maybe reading this book, either with young people or discussing it with young people or in an educational setting?
And that is really key to why I took the time to do this. I think that it's important to acknowledge the problems that exist, but by looking at them in a context that is 100 years ago, it can remove, for purposes of the discussion, some of the heavy emotions that people bring to it and get them to look at it much more factually. So what happened at the beginning, what happened at the middle, what happened at the end, and then from there, pivot on that and be able to talk about, well, how does that relate or not relate to what's going on today? And then I think it's very important as part of that discussion to, for parents and teachers and peers, to encourage young people to take action in their own lives. It doesn't have to be something that's going to end up in the newspaper and be that big. How they can start to bridge that gap themselves in small ways, maybe talking to a kid who's off on his own or her own and is not made part of the social groups that are popular at school, or going and talking to someone who comes from a different background that's in school, just having lunch. But there are many, many different ways that kids can start to be conscious and intentional about how they relate to other people, and it will give them the tools to really create a better future as they grow into adulthood.
That's Claire Hartfield. Her book delves into the history of the Chicago race riot of 1919 and the history of Black Chicagoans. It's called A Few Red Drops, The Chicago Race Riot of 1919. Again, she's got an event this evening as well if you're in the Chicago area at the 57th Street Bookstore in Hyde Park. Claire, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's the music of Black Violin. They're challenging everything from people's thoughts on musical genres to social stereotypes. And we're joined now by the South Florida duo that is Black Violin, Kev Marcus and Will Baptiste. Hey guys, thanks for being with me.
Hey, what's up? How you doing?
Thank you for having us.
When we heard just a little bit of your music there, I think lots of people have stereotypes about what classical music is or isn't. They always think it needs to be in a fancy opera house or in a symphony hall. Are people most excited? I wonder when people see you guys, the venues that you play in, do you think they, how do they react?
At first they're coming there because they hear, they see the word Black Violin, so they're like, that looks interesting. I wonder how that sounds. So they come in, they don't know what to expect, and they're completely blown away just because the idea of it, you know what I mean, hip-hop, classical, and the way that we, you know, we kind of put the two together, it's very clean and a very, you know, it lends itself to just different types of people being in the same room, experiencing music at the same time, but maybe in a different way.
You know? Kev, how did you guys get to the space of hip hop classic. And it is, I think it is a really clean mix of the way that you all synthesize your music. How did you guys get to this place?
Well, you know, we grew up in Fort Lauderdale. So, we lived in the hood and just went to a public performing arts high school. And every day, second period, we had orchestra class. So we took advantage of it and we, you know, practiced our violins and our violas and, you know, studied and, you know, took music theory and did all the things that, you know, most classical musicians do. But after we left second period, we put our headphones on. We was listening to Wu-Tang or Biggie or Nas or Jay-Z, because that's the environment we grew up in. So, you know, we had all these kinds of success happening with the violin and the viola, and we end up getting full scholarships to college and, you know, all these accolades, you know, growing up playing it. But at the same time, we was always hip hop. So, like, you know, for us blending the two together, you know, it's very natural for us. But the thing that we focus on in our music is making sure that we are extremely classical and making sure that we are extremely hip hop, and doing it at the same time with the same doses, so that two people sitting next to each other in a concert, one could have their eyes closed and just mesmerized by the strings, and then sitting right next to that person would be somebody just nodding their head uncontrollably at the hip hop bounce of it. And that's the beauty of it, you know, it's just about the mixture of it and not mixing either side too heavily, because then you lose the pure classical person, or you lose the person that just wakes up and listens to Drake all day. You know, we want to get all of them, and we want all of them to come to our concert and have a unique experience and have something that they share in common.
Well, how do you market that, right? Because I think that's a really tough thing. And how have you guys managed to maintain this career as you all are performing all over the U.S.? Because that is a really unusual space to be in. And I think in the industry, it's really hard when you're not in a specific genre to be in a space of, hey, I want to market this, because it's all about, well, what group are we trying to target?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny you say that, because that's the conversation, because we're with Universal Classic, their classical division label, and that's the thing with any music label. They want to put you in a box. They want to tell you, listen, what's your demographic? And with us, we don't have a demographic. We don't have a box. You know what I'm saying? Everyone appreciates our music. So, a way to market is just, you know, performing. You know, if you see it, you believe it, you know. And we were doing this before Twitter or any social media network. We were doing this before then. So, you know, we had to literally, you know, perform in the clubs. And if you see us, then you'll follow us on the website, or you'll come to our show if we're in a town near you. So that's our way. And that's how we've been doing it for years, because once you see us perform, you'll never forget it. You know what I mean? Like, it may be 10 years before you see us perform again, but you'll never forget that one time you've seen us perform, because it's something that you've never experienced before. You know what I mean? So that's what we do. That's our bread and butter. That's why we tour year round every year, because as much as YouTube helps and all these different networks and outlets, but ultimately when you come to a Black Violin show, that's the way we get you, you know?
All right, well, now you guys have set it up. Now you have to perform. So what are you going to play for us now?
We're going to play a song titled Stereotypes. That's the name of our album. And Stereotypes. There we go.
Black Violin. That is an acoustic performance off of their album Stereotypes. They're in studio with us at Studio F. They are going to be performing this Monday in suburban Naperville, out in the Chicago suburbs, if you can catch them. We have a chance to talk to them now. And as you guys are playing that's the acoustic version. Your produced version has, there's a lot more of the hip hop that's in there. And I'm thinking, as I was thinking about that, When you're writing your music, because you're thinking about how it's fitting into both the classical genre as well as hip hop, does that influence how fast the classical portion of it is? Does that influence the pace of it?
The pace helps, you know what I mean? Because it's something that, you know, it's driving is high, the energy is there. But we try not to really necessarily think of it. We don't necessarily go in the studio and think, how do we... It's something that really naturally comes together, and it's naturally something that we do naturally, you know what I mean? Because it's organic. We're hip hop before we were classical. So for us, you know, if you work with a producer, he puts on a beat, and whatever comes out is typically what goes on to the in the music, you know what I mean? And a lot of times it has a lot of pace, has a lot of moving. And classical is typically, you know, very lush and beautiful. And you hear stuff like that as well. I mean, obviously we'll have a lot of stuff like that on our album. But definitely pace in terms of the energy, in terms of just if you come to our show, you know, the beat is moving and we're moving with the beat. But at the same time, if we're playing like a ballad type of song, you know, we're going to play a little slower and a slower pace, you know. So it's all about really showcasing just that mix, you know what I mean? Like that mix of hip hop and just, you know, classical, but also everything else in between. If you listen to our music, I mean, there's a lot of different things in there. There's funk, there's jazz, there's bebop, and there's, you know, if you listen a little hard, you might hear a little country in there, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of different elements in our music, so.
And when I think about that, when you guys are performing, I know earlier this month you played a few shows to some kids here in Urbana. How did they react?
You mean the mosh pit? Like they were, it was a mosh pit at the kids show in Urbana. Literally, like they all just came to the front of the stage and they're just jumping up and down and dancing, you know, because it's very much like a rock concert, except instead of guitars or violins involved, you know? And the best part of it is just seeing all of their faces, you know, and then not only that, you're seeing them jumping up and down and the teachers are in it too. Like the teachers and the chaperones are like in it and they're dancing with the kids, and you know, and in what way do you ever see that, you know? So that's great. And then, you know, once we get them and like once we have them in our hand, then we give them this simple message, you know. It's simple. I'll say, give my spiel, I'll say, have you ever seen a violin concert like this? And all of them say no. And then I say, well, you know, the violin's been great, got full scholarship to college, we performed for President Obama, played all over the world with this violin, but the true point of our show is to get everyone to think outside the box and to break stereotypes. Doesn't matter how cool or uncool you thought this violin was, you can make it your own. And if you want to be a violinist, that's great. But if you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, scientist, you want to be the next LeBron James, whatever you want to do, just make sure that you are doing it in a way that no one has ever attempted. And that is the stronger, broader message. I mean, it's one thing to say, hey, you know, go get a violin and practice as much as possible. But it's another thing to say, like, whatever it is that you love to do, just do that in a way that no one else has thought of it. Violins have been around hundreds of years. We said, let's throw some 808 beats on and put some Jordans and fitted caps while we play it. And let's see what happens. And it works for us. You know, this is just our vehicle for thinking differently. So if we can give any kid or anyone that's watching some of that kind of inspiration, then our job is done.
Kev, there's a line in Stereotypes, the voiceover in the produced version, where you say, I'm completely crushing people's impressions of what a violin can do and also what a black man is capable of. Mm-hmm. And I wonder for you, especially as we think about so much of this space that we are in this country right now, of perceptions of black men, I wonder for you, I wonder how you feel like what you guys are doing is helping maybe change a little bit of the conversation.
I think it's really important, you know, for what we do to change the conversation, because, you know, with us, you know, we step on stage and, you know, certain people in certain markets that we perform in, you know, they think of a black man in a certain way, or they think of a violin in a certain way. When I was growing up, I thought a violin was really kind of corny, you know, really ballerina music. That's what I thought it was when I was growing up, you know. I'm plenty of kids, I'm sure, think that as well. And then as far as a black man, you know, I mean, I don't know many other black violin players, and I'm a black violin player. So, I mean, there's definitely...
There's you two.
There's
you
us two. I mean, we have tons of friends that do it as well. So, you know, shouts out to everybody that's listening that, you know, that's a black man or woman playing. But, you know, we don't see that often. So it's like for us, we feel like when we step on stage, it's literally kind of, it changes the person's conversation in their head of when they see a black man walking up to them, or changes their conversation of like, you know, hey, I got this classical concert this weekend. You want to come? Like, yeah, I kind of do want to come now that I've heard it in a different way, you know? So, you know, we're just happy that we're able to, you know, in a musical and cultural sense, continue the conversation of, you know, not judging a book by its cover and just freeing your mind into just being able to, you know, break stereotypes in anything that you choose to do.
That's Kev Marcus. Will Baptiste is also part of the group Black Violin. Their album is called Stereotypes. You guys can take us out with one last. What are you guys going to play for us?
I'll play a cover for you guys.
All right.
This one is at Took a Pill in Ibiza, Mike Posner. So...
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. If you want to look for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Robin Lynn and Alan Montecilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.